True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
In the early morning of February 10th, 1992, Robin Lee Rose's two-story duplex in Boise, Idaho, was engulfed in flames. Robin wasn't home that morning. She'd spent the night at a friend's house after a fight with her husband, Randy Rowe. But at 3 a.m., Robin said she had a premonition of the fire. She woke her friend at 5:30, and they drove together to the duplex to check on Robin's children. Joshua, 10 years old, Tabitha, 8 years old, and their stepfather, Randy, all died in that fire. Initially, there was an outpouring of compassion for Robin, a grieving woman who'd lost her entire family overnight. But Robin was not who she appeared to be. Her behavior after the tragedy, along with fire investigators' suspicions about the fire, led the police to look into Robin's past. After a bit of digging, they would discover that Robin had lived a lifetime of deceit, fraud, and quite possibly murder. Join us at the quiet end for Burning Down the House. The deaths of her family members in this 1992 fire were not the only suspicious deaths found in Robin's past. Information began to trickle in from acquaintances and co-workers about her web of lies and her apparent cold-heartedness. Her closest friend was her most ardent supporter, until she, too, discovered the true Robin.
So we need an Idaho beer, which is not that easy as you might think. I've only had beers from one Iowa brewery called Laughing Dog Brewing, so I'm going to stick with them, because I know them best.
And they're good.
Well, I enjoy them. But yeah, there's not much beer being brewed in Idaho compared to other states.
Certainly.
So the beer today is Sneaky Pete IPA. It's an Imperial IPA. So it's from Laughing Dog Brewery in Idaho. It is an Imperial IPA. It's got 10% alcohol by volume. So this beer is a dark amber color, big fluffy off-white head, plenty of lacing. Nice aroma, citrus, pine, some sweet malt, and this translates into grapefruit, pine, and caramel taste. It's medium-bodied. You don't really notice the alcohol, so be careful when you drink this. Don't slug them down too quickly.
No, because you'll notice it a little while after you finish it.
If you did that, yes, and then
yes.
You'd stand up and you'd be on the floor.
Huh. Well, wouldn't be the first time, would it?
Not for me. Although it would be the first time in many years.
Certainly, yes, yes. All right, let's open it up. So as you follow me down to the quiet end here, I just have to say I saw you earlier as I came out of the women's restroom speaking with Gold Chain Guy, and it looks like did you give him a beer or something?
Yeah, he was between beers, so I bought him one. And we had a nice little chat.
So tell me a little bit about him. Is he creepy or is he really a
nice
guy?
No, he's a nice guy. He just tries too hard, I think.
Yes.
And we need to give him some advice on grooming and conversing.
Oh, like we're the experts, sure.
Well, we are. Look at us.
Okay, well, I think he's doing okay with his wife beater and his gold chains. As long as he keeps that chest hair trimmed.
Yeah, well, I told him that a lot of people don't think those T-shirts are real cool.
Yes.
Me among them.
Uh-huh.
And he seemed to listen. Now, he's probably not going to go running out and buy a golf shirt or anything like that. But I'm just looking for a little step up from the wife beater. Maybe just a plain white T-shirt or something.
Well, we'll keep an eye open over the next few weeks and see what happens.
See what we get.
So, I think we should begin this story with Robin's early life and try and make some kind of sense out of where her antisocial and manipulative behavior originated, because she certainly had a lot of it.
She has some history.
Yes.
Oh, holy cow.
An interesting person.
So, she was born in 1957 in Nashua, New Hampshire. Her birth name was Robin Lee Cornelier, and she was the oldest of five kids. Now, her parents, Virginia and Charles, were only 16 and 17 years old when they had her. So my thinking is that Mom was probably pregnant, and it was a marriage of convenience type of thing.
Well, it was certainly a rough start for Robin. I'll give her that.
Sure was. So Nashua is and was a small, primarily working-class city. In the 50s, when Robin was born, it had a population of around 40,000 people, and now probably around 100,000. The family, the Cornelier family, was very poor. Virginia worked for an electric company, but Charles was an alcoholic, often unemployed, and even when he was employed, he would tend to spend his paycheck on alcohol and not on his family. Robin was very upset for being poor, more so than with her younger siblings. And even though most of the kids' friends were poor also, Robin was ashamed to bring anyone home. She constantly complained about their house, their clothing, furnishings, their beat-up old car they had. Nothing was good, according to Robin.
Well, you know, I bet it wasn't great.
I'm sure it wasn't.
But I think this just really became part of who she was, and not in a good way. But, you know, the family also had other problems, problems bigger than money. Neither Virginia nor Charles was affectionate with any of the children, and there was constant fighting and very little encouragement. In her teens, Robin was often in conflict with her youngest sister, Terry, and with her mother. Virginia filed for divorce from Charles, and she was awarded custody of all five of their children. Terry was happy when their dad moved out, but Robin had really identified with her dad. She was always trying to earn his love, and she blamed Virginia, her mom, for the divorce, even though Charles was clearly the biggest offender in this marriage. So I guess we could simplify that by saying she had daddy issues.
Okay. And what you were saying earlier was lack of affection in the household. That's going to play a big role in how well kids do as adults.
Yes, and it really did seem with her, she didn't really bond with her own children.
Right.
So that's really just sad.
I mean, that's much more of an issue than the poverty that they were raised in.
Yes, but I think that poverty just affects everything in the house. When you're talking real poverty,
sure.
If you're constantly worrying about what you're going to eat or how you're going to keep the bills paid, it's hard to be affectionate and do a lot.
Right.
So it's all one big heap of shit, really, together. None of it's good.
None of it's good. Now, in 1975, Charles was locked up in the New Hampshire State Penitentiary for life because he murdered an antique dealer during an attempted robbery. So despite his violence and self-destruction, Robin still loved her father. But her relationship with her mother, already not very good, went into a downward spiral as Robin continued to blame her for pretty much all the issues in the family. All of the kids in the family fell into trouble in their teen years, although the youngest one, Terry, escaped that. Robin was pregnant at age 14. Her mother took her to New York for an abortion. Then at age 15, Robin ran away with a boy and found herself in juvenile detention. Then again at age 16, she was pregnant for the second time that we know of. She went through this pregnancy and gave birth to a boy she named Keith. Keith's father was an ex-boyfriend of Robin's. His name was Mitch, and he lived just north of Nashua.
Yeah, but he was not great either.
Nope.
So in 1975, just a year after Keith was born, Robin gave birth to a girl, Christina May. So both Keith and Christina were happy, healthy babies, at least starting out. Robin's family had no idea who Christina's father was, and her sister Terry wondered if Robin even knew who her baby's father was, because she was getting around quite a bit. So by the time she was 19, Robin was a single mom of two living on public assistance. She was able to convince three of her ex-lovers that Christina was their baby, and she ended up receiving child support from at least two of them for a while. So she's already very manipulative early on here.
Enterprising, you could say.
Okay. So Robin was introduced to a 17-year-old named Wayne Hamilton, who was part of a group who would go out and set fire to cars to get money from insurance companies. So people would hire these teens to steal their cars and set them on fire. And when the owner collected an insurance payout, they'd give $50 to $100 to these young arsonists. When Wayne was caught and arrested for burning a car, he was given the choice of jail or joining the military. So he chose the military. So Wayne didn't have much time with Robin before he joined the Marines. He was stationed in New York, but Robin did continue to write to him often. They continued this long-distance relationship, and he sent money to help out Robin with her kids whenever he could. But shortly after he left for New York, there was a fire in Robin's apartment building. There was serious damage to the apartment, so Robin and her children moved back in with her mother and her 14-year-old sister, Terry. Terry and Virginia were very convenient babysitters, allowing Robin to go out and enjoy her freedom. In fact, Virginia took over most of the care of baby Christina, who Robin just didn't show much maternal love for. On January 30th, 1977, Christina slept in Terry's room, and this wasn't unusual. But the following morning, as Virginia got ready for work and Terry got ready to go to school, Terry took the toddler into Robin's room to care for her. Christina was 15 months old. Just a couple of hours later, Terry was called out of her class for a family emergency. And when she rushed home, she heard Robin's version of what had happened that morning. Robin said she'd gone into the kitchen to get some milk for her daughter, leaving her lying on the bed. And when she came back, she said the dog was in the bedroom and Christina was lying there motionless. So Christina had suddenly died at the age of 15 months. Her death was determined to be a case of SIDS, and Robin pushed the idea that it had been the dog's hair that had caused Christina's death. There had been a theory in the late 1970s that linked animal hair to SIDS, but SIDS occurs in the first 12 months of life, with the peak age between 3 to 4 months old.
Yeah, and that theory that looked at animal hair and SIDS really didn't have much legs on it. Disappeared pretty quickly.
Yes, but Robin really clung to it.
Oh, sure. It's a good excuse.
And as we know, there can be a fine line between identifying death by suffocation and death by SIDS. So basically, the medical examiner had found no cause of death and labeled Christina's death SIDS. Christina was buried in a really crappy-looking section of the Woodlawn Cemetery, and there was no headstone and no marker for it. Wayne Hamilton was out on operations when he got the notification that Robin's daughter Christina had died. And of course, he was worried for Robin, and his sympathy for her grew as she sent him emotional letters describing her sorrow. When the Marine Corps transferred Wayne from New York to Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, Robin and Keith planned to join him there. But before she left for North Carolina, Robin hung paper, as they say. She was picked up for passing bad checks. Then she was released. She was still just 19 years old when she brought Keith with her to North Carolina to stay with Wayne. Then less than 2 months after Christina's death in March of 1977, Wayne and Robin got married. Then they lived off base in a small mobile home. A few weeks into the marriage, Wayne went to bed before Robin in the only bedroom, which was at the back of the home. The couple shared this room with Keith, and he was already asleep. But that night, Robin decided to sleep on the couch, and this was something she'd never done before.
Then in the middle of the night, Wayne was woken up by the sound of a loud bang, and he saw flames shooting up in the dark from the top of a chest of drawers. He's panicked. There's smoke and all this noise and stuff. He runs into the living room. Robin said she'd been sleeping and didn't know what had happened. But she did suggest that 3-year-old Keith might be somehow responsible for the fire.
Which Wayne thought was pretty ludicrous.
Wayne, though, also thought it had to have been some kind of weird accident.
Well, what else would you think?
Sure. So there was a can of gunpowder on top of the chest of drawers, which had flashed, and that caused the sound that woke Wayne. Now, in retrospect, he thought it was really strange that the dresser, located near the door on the wall that separated the kitchen from the bedroom, would just spontaneously ignite, which is a reasonable thing to think.
That doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't.
But they didn't call the fire department, so there was no investigation. Wayne just felt lucky that he'd woken up soon enough to put out the flames. Now, if he had died in a fire that night, the Marines would have sent $10,000 in life insurance benefits to his next of kin. That would be his young wife, Robin. But this incident was the beginning of the end of this marriage. In the beginning, Wayne thought Robin was a good wife and a good mother to her son. And he did care about Keith, too, this cute blue-eyed boy with a big open smile. But one evening, soon after the fire, Wayne came home to an empty apartment. There was no note, and Robin hadn't called him. Robin and Keith had just disappeared. After a day and a half, she did come back, but she had an unbelievable story about where she'd been. Wayne began to question his decision to marry this woman, who he really hadn't known, let's be honest.
No, he sure didn't.
So after Robin returned from this odd disappearance, Wayne noticed that her wedding ring was missing too. And when he asked her about it, she said she'd lost it in their backyard while playing frisbee. She said it had slipped off and it was in the grass. So together they combed through the grass and searched for the ring, but it was never found. Later on, Wayne found out the truth about Robin's disappearance. She'd been arrested for writing bad checks and charged with forgery. So Wayne was starting to see through her lies, and he guessed that she had probably pawned that diamond ring to make her bail.
Yeah, now after that incident, or realization, I guess, the relationship unraveled pretty quickly. Robin got convicted of forgery and was sent to the North Carolina State Penitentiary for a 4-year sentence. Wayne took care of Keith for a while, but he found that the burden of caring for a toddler while in the military was too much for him. So he had to send Keith back to New Hampshire to stay with Robin's sister, Terry.
But while she was in custody, Robin wrote a letter to the judge, and this was dated September 8, 1977. She asked for immediate work release, and she used Keith to gain his sympathy. So she wrote in part, "My 15-month-old daughter died in January. My son is beginning to realize that she won't be coming home. Lately, my son has been asking my sister if Mommy is dead. Every time I talk to him on the telephone, he cries and he says, 'I want to go home.'" So it worked. In March of 1978, she was released on parole. And by that time, Wayne had filed for a divorce. Strange things seemed to happen when she was around, and there were just too many lies for him to even keep straight anymore. So Robin moved back to New Hampshire. Back in Nashua, Robin and her sister Terry traded babysitting duties. According to Terry, she took care of her 5-year-old nephew Keith most of the time, and she was used to caring for him during Robin's time in prison, so that wasn't a big deal. But she had her own daughter by now, who she had also named Christina, and she lived in a 2-bedroom apartment. So Terry was staying in 1 bedroom, and the children stayed in the 2nd. Although Robin didn't live there, she had a key to Terry's 2nd-floor apartment. So Terry was woken up one night by Keith and Christina screaming. Then she heard the crackling and spitting of a fire. Both exits, the kitchen door and the living room door, were blocked by this fire. Grabbing and carrying the 2 children, one under each arm, Terry ran right through the flames in a desperate escape. Because the cries of the children, the 3 of them had made it out alive. But afterward, Terry realized she hadn't heard the smoke alarm, which was in the hallway near the bedrooms. The fire department had difficulty finding the cause of this fire, and for lack of evidence, the cause of the fire was listed as electrical. Terry remembered Robin's recent advice to her and had a bit of a chill run down her spine, because Robin had said to her, "It's a good idea to have life insurance on your children."
Well, that's some pronunciation, huh?
It is, and Terry had grown up with Robin, so she had a pretty good feel for things not being right.
Yeah, and I would consider that one of those things, not being right.
Absolutely.
Even though, fortunately, everybody survived.
But there are a lot of fires going on here in Robin's life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's at least 2 now, right? In 1980, Robin and Keith moved to California. A friend of hers named Debbie gave Robin and Keith a temporary home and a vacant cabin she owned, and this was in the small town of Somerville. Now, I think calling it a cabin is kind of kind to it. It's a 800-square-foot shack, old, poorly built, constructed of this porous wood with a corrugated steel roof. For electricity or for light, there's a single bulb hanging from a ratty old wire with a switch attached. Robin had no job. She had no transportation. She applied for AFDC, which is Aid for Families with Dependent Children. She was poor, and she's basically stuck. Now, there certainly was not much to do in Somerville. There was a lodge, some cabins, and there was a small roadside cafe/bar that served as the local hangout. Miners and loggers came in after work to socialize and to drink. So on a Thursday evening in June, June 19th, Robin went to the bar. She played pool, chatted with some friends. Keith went along with her. When Robin and Keith got home, it was after midnight, and it had been a pretty hot day. So Robin put Keith to bed in their enclosed porch, which served as his bedroom. It had two doors, one to the outside and one to the living room area.
Yeah, Keith slept with his favorite blanket, a large quilt, and his little kitten. Around 1:30 a.m., a couple of neighbors were startled from their sleep by a loud pounding on their door. They opened their door and saw their next-door neighbor, Robin Hamilton, who lived only 100 feet from their residence, standing on their porch in her nightgown and shoes, screaming. They saw smoke coming from Robin's shack. When they asked where Keith was, Robin seemed to take forever to answer. She finally told Mr. Brown that her son was trapped in the bathroom. So Mr. Brown ran over and broke out that bathroom window, but when he looked inside, he saw nothing, just the smoke and flames. Robin was still talking to Mrs. Brown, and she'd already calmed down. Then she told Mr. Brown that Keith was actually in his bedroom, not the bathroom. So Mr. Brown tried the outside door to Keith's porch/bedroom, but it was padlocked from the inside. Still, Brown didn't hesitate to enter the shack, which was quickly becoming very engulfed in fire. But he knows there's a little boy in there, so he's not going to give up easily, of course.
Right.
So Mr. Brown crawled, moving through the living room to the door to Keith's room. There was a couch against the door to the outside, but the interior door was partially open. So, unable to see through the smoke, he slithered across the bedroom, searching on the floor for the boy. He got to the head of the bed, but he felt nothing. Then the smoke became too thick for him to breathe, and he had to leave. It was the U.S. Forest Service that was the first agency to respond to this fire. Detective Chuck Sanborn followed the one fire engine to the scene. He called the fire marshal in Redding, and after finding that someone had died in this fire, he called the county coroner. And by the time the fire was out, only a small portion of the cabin was still intact. When Robin talked about Keith and the fire, she was emotional and visibly distraught. She explained that she had come home at 12:30 or 12:45, made up Keith's bed, and put him to sleep before she went to bed in the other bedroom. Then, a few minutes before 1:30, her cat jumped on her and woke her up. She smelled smoke and saw fire in Keith's bedroom. Then she tried to get into his room, she said, but she couldn't, so she ran to the next-door neighbors for help.
So was she able to say why she couldn't get into his room?
No, just that the fire was too much for her.
Now, despite her really emotional condition, Robin was able to make it clear to the ambulance attendant, whose name was Doug Trowbridge, that she was attracted to him. No time like the present, right?
Well, yeah, you can't let any time waste.
So later she insisted that he had pulled her from the fire and saved her life, which was not true.
No, he had only driven her to the hospital.
The cabin had burned to the ground, but was still smoking when Robin left in the ambulance. It was 8 o'clock in the morning before the firemen had it cooled down enough for investigators to go in and search for Keith. The floor had burned through completely, and the roof had fallen through to the ground. Detective Sanborn was and is an experienced investigator. And over the years, he had learned that the best way to find dead people in a house destroyed by fire was to back away from the rubble and take a thorough look.
Yeah, I can see sometimes it's better to get the big picture.
Yeah, because usually some part of the body, like a skull, for example, would stand out in the debris.
Well, that's kind of a horrible thought, though. God.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Now, finally, as he's looking through all this debris and damage, he saw a small backbone.
Ugh.
So the little Keith's flesh had burned away, and part of the roof had fallen down on top of his corpse. So the coroner and investigators found his body lying on its right side at the foot of the bed. The neighbor had missed locating him just by inches. Keith seemed to have been moving away from the door, as if he was making an attempt to get out into the living room. Heartbreaking sight. And certainly the people who were there investigating and found the child, they're never going to forget that.
No, that would be permanently etched in their minds. Investigators did find an electric portable heater with some kind of cloth or bedding in front of it. It was pushed up against the middle of the bed with the mattress overlapping the bed frame and hanging close to it. It was plugged into an extension cord, and it was in the on position. Then in a chair about 5 feet from the bed, they found the charred bones of Keith's little kitten. So Robin and her cat got out, but Keith and his kitten died in the fire. Fire investigators determined that the electric heater was the source of the fire and that it had ignited the cloth material that had been piled up against it. At 2 p.m. that afternoon, Robin returned to the scene. She acted confused and didn't really have much to say when they questioned her. She did say that Keith knew how to operate the heater in his room, and he sometimes played with it by turning on a light switch, which gave power to the electrical heater from a cord. She also told investigators that she was poor and on assistance. When asked if she had any insurance, she claimed that she didn't have any. Even though the investigators found Robin to be very evasive and learned that she had made some contradictory statements, there was really nothing specific that they felt they could use to prove foul play on her part. Poor little Keith was too charred for testing for carbon monoxide poisoning or any drugs, so accidental was listed under manner of death in the coroner's report.
Yeah, and the coroner who performed the autopsy on Keith listed his cause of death as incineration because his body was so extensively charred that it was impossible to determine if he had died of smoke inhalation or some other cause. I'm going to forego the details of the autopsy. It's a 6-year-old little kid. I can't do it. Basically, his body was destroyed by the fire. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, it was absolutely violent and horrific. A terrible, terrible way to die. We can't say that enough.
No.
But Detective Sanborn really felt certain that something wasn't right here. Robin had appeared shocked and distraught, but his instincts and experience indicated to him that she was conniving and quite dishonest. It was unusual to have a heater turned on in the middle of summer, for one thing, and certainly unsafe to leave a 6-year-old alone in a room with a space heater, especially a room in this kind of condition. Things just didn't add up for him, but just having that feeling wouldn't help out in court. In order to get a conviction, they would need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime had been committed. And the DA decided there wasn't enough evidence to build a case. So that was the kind of the end of it for there. Still, Sanborn wasn't finished with her. Services for Keith were held 4 days after the fire, and of course the casket was closed for the ceremony. They had Keith's remains wrapped up in a blanket inside. Keith was cremated after the service, and Robin's mother paid the almost $600 for the services and the cremation. Robin paid $18 for packaging and shipping Keith's remains to New Hampshire, where her mother took care of the arrangements there. So as it had been for Christina, no headstone or marker was placed on this grave. So Robin has lost 2 children, and I would not hesitate to say in suspicious ways.
Absolutely. The local investigators didn't know it, but in his short 6-year life, Keith had lived in 3 locations and had been involved in house fires at all 3 of those locations. Most people don't experience even 1 fire in a whole lifetime. This kid's had 3 in 6 years. Detective Sanborn learned from the coroner that Robin had requested several certified copies of Keith's death certificate. And after the fire, he learned that Robin had taken out a $14,000 life insurance policy on Keith in May, which was just a month before the fire, and she had added a double indemnity clause that brought the total accidental death benefit to $28,000. So there certainly isn't a law against insurance policies, but one that had been taken out a month before his death with that double indemnity clause, that's a little bit disturbing, would you not say?
I think more than a little bit. This is a poor woman who's getting food stamps and living on assistance. Why would you spend any of your money on life insurance for your child if you're in those circumstances?
Yeah, I know.
And back then, $28,000, especially for someone in such poverty, is a lot of money. I mean, it's a lot of money anyway. But for her, this is kind of life-changing money if you think about it. So it's very suspicious. So now she was homeless and alone. Both of her children had died in separate, unusual circumstances. So she moved into the Whispering Pines Apartments in Pine Creek in July of 1980. She was still receiving public assistance as she waited for the insurance payout from her son's death. Angela Cheney, a county social worker, helped her deal with Keith's death. But Robin really didn't grieve for very long. She called up that ambulance attendant, Doug Trowbridge, to thank him for saving her life. Now remember, he'd only driven her to the hospital, but Robin was quite insistent that Doug had saved her life, and she told him she wanted to get to know him better. Now during this time, Robin had long, pretty hair, and she weighed about 125 pounds. Now she was no beauty, but she was more attractive than the short, pudgy Robin, who lived in Boise in her later years. Doug thought Robin was nice, and there weren't a lot of single women in that area. And obviously Robin wanted him. She was about the same age, but much more manipulative and much more sexually experienced. By August, they were sleeping together. Then, in early 1981, Robin received her $28,000. She spent $12,000 on a new black and silver Toyota Celica with a T-top. Then she put money down on a double-wide mobile home and lived in a trailer park in Pine Creek. Robin's younger sister, Terry, who was now 16 years old, came from New Hampshire to visit. Now, life wasn't good back home, so Terry decided she'd stay there and go to high school in California. As a way to explain her improved finances to her sister, Robin told Terry that she'd received money from the landlord's insurance because of that fire. But remember, Terry wasn't so convinced about her niece Christina's death, so Terry is suspicious of her sister, even this early on.
Right, she was. Now, Robin was happy with her financial situation, because it was certainly the best it had ever been. But then Doug broke up with her. He had seen for himself that Robin was a habitual liar. It was also concerning how she could change her personality from one moment to the next. In her efforts to keep Doug, Robin made friends with his co-workers. He refused still to give her another chance. She attempted suicide by taking pills. So whether this was a genuine attempt or a gesture, Doug wasn't sure. Coincidentally, or maybe it was planned that way, Doug was the EMT sent out on an ambulance call in response to the suicide attempt. Robin then told him she was pregnant with twins, suggesting that he was the father. Doug didn't fall for that one.
A while back, I was looking for a matching puzzle game that would challenge me. Something different that would require more than one basic strategy round after round. And then I found Best Fiends. It's a mobile puzzle game that challenges and refreshes my brain. Playing Best Fiends makes me feel like I swam a few laps before I got pampered with a luxurious shower and a deep tissue massage. Sounds good, huh?
Sure does. I actually like Best Fiends also. It makes my brain feel exercised and replenished and ready to take on the day's responsibilities. It's way more fun than any other matching puzzle game I've tried. So much more satisfying than that game where you just smash candy pieces over and over. Now, one complaint I do have. It's too much fun. I can't stop playing.
Uh-huh.
But I'll never get bored with Best Fiends. Best Fiends actually has thousands of puzzles to solve. I'm now on level 133.
Oh, you're such a show-off.
Just stating the facts, ma'am.
But with Best Fiends, there is something new to play every day. And the adorable characters you collect as you go just keep coming. Not only can I match up different things, I also get to blow up boxes that have creatures inside of them. It's very satisfying to see that wood fly and have those little creatures pop out.
If you're like we used to be, having doubts about ever finding a puzzle game with more challenges and rewards to offer, I have a solid bit of advice for you. Give Best Fiends a try. But no blaming me if you can't put it down. So download the 5-star rated puzzle game, Best Fiends, free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
This episode is also sponsored by Apostrophe, a prescription skincare company for people who are ready to take their acne seriously. Fun fact, most home remedies and over-the-counter acne products just don't work. And even worse, they can even damage your skin. Brings me back to when I was a teenager. My Auntie Annette told me if I put peroxide on my face twice a day, I wouldn't have breakouts. And in case you're wondering, this didn't work. My skin was very dry and sore, and I still had breakouts. But don't blame Auntie. She meant well. She just wasn't a doctor. Now that I'm older and wiser, I want real medicine for my real skin issues. But prescription acne treatment can be hard to get. First, you have to take time off of work, go see a doctor, and then line up at the pharmacy to get the actual medication. With Apostrophe, it's just easy. Apostrophe connects you with a board-certified dermatologist who will create a personalized treatment plan that's just perfectly tailored to your unique skin. Simply fill out Apostrophe's online quiz about your skin goals and your medical history, then snap a few selfies, and your dermatologist will create your customized treatment plan. The best part is that Apostrophe offers topical and oral medications, so you can treat your acne from the inside out or from the outside in. Apostrophe treats acne, and they can also help you hit your other skincare goals, like getting rid of redness, wrinkles, and dark spots. Apostrophe's helped me out with prescription-strength creams to lighten dark spots and prevent adult acne outbreaks. My prescription cream came in an easy-to-use pump bottle with some really adorable stickers so I could personalize it and make it my own. It's a little touch I wouldn't have thought of, and it arrived just days after that online visit. I was pretty impressed. We have a special deal for our audience, too. Save $15 off your first visit with a board-certified dermatologist at apostrophe.com/TCB when you use our code TCB. This code is only available to our listeners. To get started, just go to apostrophe.com/TCB, then click Begin Visit. Then use our code TCB at sign up, and you'll get $15 off your dermatology visit. That's apostrophe.com/TCB. And use that code TCB to get your dermatology visit and save $15. And thank you to Apostrophe for sponsoring the podcast.
Robin went to the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act office for help, and they found her a position there as a clerk. Now, within weeks, she told them that she was pregnant. Valerie, a woman who worked closely with Robin, asked her, "Is this your first?" Robin told her about Christina and went into great detail about crib death. She also told her that Christina had been blind, which wasn't true. Later, she would tell another good friend, Joan McHugh, that Christina had breathing problems and tell someone else that her daughter had multiple sclerosis. Valerie was not sympathetic or trusting. She actually felt unsure about Robin from the first day she met her. Now then, one day, Robin didn't show up for work, but she did call and she explained that she had gone to a hospital and had been diagnosed with breast cancer. Then later she told everyone that she had been miraculously cured. While doing a surgical procedure for the twins she said she was carrying, the doctors saw that her cancer had completely disappeared. Okay, but then a few weeks later, Robin disappeared again. She called her office on a Monday morning and told the supervisor that she had been in San Francisco over the weekend and had delivered premature twins. One was dead, she said, and the other one was in the neonatal intensive care unit, where her hospital bill was $3,000 each day. Then she claimed that the second baby died within a week of its birth. Now, when the supervisor told the employees what Robin had said, Valerie just couldn't believe it. Robin was using other people's stories to put together her own story. Valerie had once told Robin about her daughter who'd been in a NICU, costing $3,000 per day. She knows that Robin's a liar. She discussed with her boss the coincidences in Robin's excuses from being away from work and her suspicions that Robin was modifying other people's stories, slightly or not so slightly, to use them as her own.
Valerie had also noticed that Robin used other facts based on an incident from another employee's life, Angela. This Angela had been diagnosed with breast cancer and had gone to the hospital recently for treatment. So it seems like Robin got both of her ideas from these two coworkers.
Sounds like, doesn't it?
Yes.
So Valerie decided she's going to check up on Robin. She called the hospital in San Francisco. They'd never heard of Robin. And there had been no twins born there, premature or otherwise, during the time period Robin said she'd been there. So after the supervisor confronted Robin, she just never returned to her job.
Well, she was caught.
Yeah. Can't go back.
No.
Valerie believed that Robin might have actually been pregnant and had had either an abortion or a miscarriage. But she did become pregnant again a couple months later, and in December of 1981, gave birth to a boy she named Joshua.
So it's kind of hard to keep track of her pregnancies, because a lot of them were made up.
Yes.
But after Joshua was born, Robin told Doug that she had given birth to twins and that he was the father. Her story to him was that one twin had died at birth and the other had lived, a baby boy named Joshua. Doug didn't know if he was the father or not, but Robin had already set her sights now on another attractive young man, and this man, Steve, was in his early 20s and just a really sweet guy. Steve had been working in a convenience store when Robin came in and struck up a friendly conversation with him. The next night, she invited him to come to her house and talk. She was a good talker and listener and made Steve feel like a good friend. Robin soon pressured him into moving into her mobile home with her. During the time Steve lived with Robin, she was pregnant and kept her home very nice. She shopped often, buying household items and new furniture. And Steve was always surprised that on her income, she could afford this new home and all these furnishings, along with the new car. During this time, Robin was working as a bookkeeper for a craft store, and she would be caught embezzling over $5,300. Robin's sister, Terry, was with the detective when he searched that mobile home. A policy they found with Terry's name as an insured person and Robin as the beneficiary was a huge shock to Terry. She already believed that Robin had killed Christina, Robin's daughter, and she also had her suspicions about Keith's death. The policy with her name on it was a warning to her that Robin intended to eventually kill her sister. I mean, why else would she spend money on life insurance? It's weird.
There's no other reason I could tell.
No. So Terry did confront Robin, but Robin calmly explained that that policy was meant to be a graduation present. Of course.
Sure.
That's what people always get for graduation.
Doesn't every high school grad want a life insurance policy?
Yeah, why not? So this was just a terrible attempt at an explanation, and Terry was not buying it. And detectives were really concerned about Terry and really anyone who was close to Robin. So most of all, they were worried about the safety of Joshua because he was completely dependent on his mother, of course. So CPS was called about Robin being neglectful with Joshua, and he was quickly placed in foster care. So Joshua went to live with a couple named Jack and Alice Woods. After that, Robin packed up and planned to jump bail, but Steve notified the police, and they were able to arrest her before she got away. So Robin pled guilty to a felony charge of grand theft and was sentenced to 3 years in prison, and this is for the embezzlement. She served 9 months in county jail, followed by 3 years probation, and an order to cooperate with a plan for psychological counseling. Under her probation order, Robin was required to make restitution of $150 per month or more if she could afford it until that $5,300 was paid in full.
That's like 3 years of payments. Wow. So Jack and Alice Woods brought baby Joshua to the jail to visit Robin every 2 weeks for 8 months. By the end of Robin's jail term, the Woods had fostered Joshua for most of his first year of life. He was their baby, and he called them Mommy and Papa. While in jail, Robin continued seeing a social worker, and her psychological evaluation indicated that the social worker had some serious concerns about returning Joshua to his mother. In part, the evaluation read, "Robin has a serious problem with psychopathic lying. Outpatient counseling does not seem to be adequate to effect a significant change. I do not feel that her mental condition is such that she can be assured of providing reasonable care to Joshua until she has had a period of intensive mental health treatment and evaluation. Results of the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory test, given to Robin in September were not positive. Patient is likely to show a history of social maladjustment and seriously disrupted interpersonal relationships, particularly with the opposite sex. May show antisocial acting out, defective judgment, poor work history is also likely. Although the patient may appear sociopathic, the possibility of a psychotic or pre-psychotic condition should be considered. Prognosis is poor. Faced with frustration, she may become irritable, aggressive, or impulsive. Test results on this patient are strongly suggestive of a major emotional disorder.
So that doesn't sound great, does it?
Doesn't sound like she's ever going to get that kid.
Well, you would hope that would have happened. In December of 1983, after she was released from jail, a psychologist concluded, "Robin has her own unique way of dealing with her world, which may or may not coincide with accepted standards of behavior. She's not likely to change this style and would be a poor psychotherapeutic risk. Test results are strongly suggestive of a major emotional disorder. She's not likely to be predictable in her behavior, stable in her moods, or rational in her thinking." But then her social worker released another report, and she was found fit to have Joshua returned to her. This report concluded, "I see no evidence of active psychosis or other disability that would indicate Robin is unable to care for herself or Joshua. She has expressed a desire and a willingness to continue in counseling. Although major changes are not expected in therapy, she would probably benefit from this contact."
So is this the same psychologist, social worker, who had given that scathing report?
I don't believe so, no. I think she ended up seeing other people.
Okay. So maybe she kind of shopped around till she got the correct diagnosis?
I don't know if that's the case, but even that last one that allowed her to have her son back is not a rave review.
No.
I mean, it's saying that therapy probably won't make much of a change.
Yeah, I know.
So really, I think giving her back that child, and it's easy to say it in hindsight, but it certainly seems like a mistake, especially since he was in a family where he seemed to be well-loved and happy.
Yeah, he was doing well.
But when Robin did get out of jail, she sold her mobile home and she moved into a small house. Despite those issues in her evaluations, Joshua was returned to her. The day Alice Woods gave Joshua back to Robin, she would say, was one of the most difficult in her entire life. But she did want Robin to be successful in mothering Joshua. Robin allowed Joshua to visit the Woodses at least 1 week a month, and Alice managed to get Robin to warm up to them and eventually felt like they were friends. The Woodses hoped that Robin could turn her life around, and they wanted to do everything they could to help her and Joshua. It seemed like she was trying to be a good mother. Alice noticed that Robin seemed very cold, though, and didn't show much affection to Joshua, but she still hoped that over time Robin would become more loving. Alice was quite sympathetic, and she would look back on Robin's life and realized she hadn't really had the best childhood herself, so Alice felt she could help both of them. But what she didn't really realize was how cold-hearted and selfish Robin really could be. And before long, Robin was pregnant again. She would tell three different men that he was the father. Robin called Steve when Tabitha was 2 months old and demanded child support from him. When Steve suggested getting a blood test, she blew up, she yelled at him, and slammed down the phone. She wasn't going to do that.
Huh, no.
Then she tried to get child support for Tabitha from another short-term ex-lover named Jim. Doug had also received papers claiming that he was Joshua's father. So the three men continued to question their paternity, and they asked for blood tests, and Robin just refused to have them done. But even without the tests, there were some physical similarities between Doug and Joshua. So in the end, even though he never saw Joshua, and he felt that Robin was deliberately keeping him away from him, Doug did pay child support for Joshua. Then Robin contacted Jim's family and sent them pictures of Tabitha. And although Jim still wasn't convinced that he was the little girl's father, he began paying child support for Tabitha. When Tabitha was a few months old, Robin tried to reunite with Steve, but he wasn't interested. Still, he was worried about the kid's safety. Detective Sanborn saw a very scary side to Robin. She was cold and calculating, and she had told Sanborn that she was working with the New Hampshire police on a case. She said there was a serial rapist who was tracking her down. He'd killed 4 other victims, she said, and she was next on his list. But when Sanborn checked this out by calling the police in New Hampshire, they had a totally different story. It was totally made up. There was no rapist coming after her. no big surprise.
He told Robin that he thought karma would destroy her future. Somebody is going to get you, he said. Someday it's all going to catch up with you. Now, Robin certainly didn't appreciate his comments.
No.
She said, fuck off. And that was the last time Detective Sanborn would speak with Robin.
Yes, but he would hear about her later. In 1985, Robin was living in Redding, California, and she made a new friend, her neighbor Ruth. Ruth, too, was a struggling single mother. She had two daughters. Robin and Ruth often had coffee together, and they would take turns babysitting for each other. They also liked to go out and play bingo. As they became closer, Ruth gave Robin a key to her place. And then they would pool their money to buy bingo cards together. But after a few months of being friends, Robin stopped paying her share. Then there was the night when a fire broke out in Ruth's house. It had started in her daughter's bedroom behind a cabinet. Ruth was able to put it out, but she called the fire department. The investigators believed that this fire was arson, but they couldn't prove it. So unknown was listed as the cause of the fire. But Ruth just couldn't understand what had started a fire in such an odd place. She also felt like the investigators were suspecting that she had started the fire for insurance. But she didn't have any insurance on her mobile home, and she had nothing to gain by destroying it. So it would be months before Ruth would suspect the truth and learn that Robin had actually taken out life insurance on her.
Whoops. And then Ruth got a call from her bank. Her account had been completely drained. So after she looked at the canceled checks, Ruth saw that Robin was responsible. Then in November of 1986, Ruth contacted the Redding Police Department, spoke to an investigator. She showed him several checks that she believed Robin had forged, and told the investigator she believed that Robin had been intercepting her bank statements from the mailbox. And Robin must have used her key, gone through her house, and found her checks. The missing checks were all taken from a single pad and replaced the other pads in a box of checks. So then Robin had gambled Ruth's money away at bingo games. When Ruth asked her where she was getting the money to go to bingo so often, Ruth had told her, "Oh, I'm winning." Ruth also learned that Robin had been selling her food stamps for cash. And to cover the forged checks, Robin was tearing up some bill payments that Ruth had trusted her to mail for her. So Ruth had lost about 2 months' pay to Robin, her credit rating was damaged, her utilities were shut off, and her rent checks bounced. What a good pal.
So it's just really crazy. You have to think, she's supposed to be like her best friend, two single moms helping each other out, right? But
right.
Then she takes her key, goes through, digs out some checks, forges checks to steal money from her, someone who has really not much money at all. And then when her friend gives her checks to pay her electric bills and whatnot, Robin just tore those up. So she really screwed her royally.
She certainly did.
It's a big betrayal. I mean, it's not by a long shot the worst thing that Robin did, but it certainly shows that she had no conscience whatsoever.
None.
During the preliminary hearing for the theft, Robin claimed that Ruth had given her permission to write the checks. But the evidence showed that Robin had cashed Ruth's checks at several bingo operations. Robin was released on bail on April 2, 1987, and then she was supposed to return for trial that August. She convinced her sister Terry and her new husband to post bail for her. And without telling anyone her plans, she packed up a few of her belongings and her two children, got in her car, and left the state. So she'd left behind questions and damage to pretty much everyone who had known her there. There were several men left wondering about the paternity of her children. Jim was continuing to pay child support for Tabitha, and Doug had been planning to try and get custody of Joshua. Jack and Alice Woods, who had expected to have custody of the children after Robin's most recent arrest, were left with payments due on Robin's mobile home space that they had leased out for her. And Terry lost the money she had put up for Robin's bail. Robin's car made it as far as Nevada before it broke down, so she just left it at a gas station with most of their possessions still inside and bought bus tickets for Boise, Idaho.
So in 1987, 30-year-old Robin Lee Cornelier and her two children, Joshua and Tabitha, arrived in Boise. She arrived on the bus in the middle of downtown with two children, two suitcases, and a couple dollars in her pocket. Robin, 5-year-old Joshua, and 3-year-old Tabitha were homeless. So the local sheriff's office sent the family of three to a temporary shelter, where they were given beds to sleep in and two meals a day. Robin claimed it was useless to apply for work because she didn't have a phone or a permanent address. She found a soup kitchen at a church. The YWCA homeless program coordinator, Mary Lou Beck, took the family under her wing.
Yeah, Mary Lou really helped out. She helped Robin get food stamps, AFDC benefits, and subsidized housing. The county provided funds for them to stay in a motel for a few weeks until she could get a more permanent place. Robin said she and her children had left the Sacramento Valley in California, where her husband was an unemployed mechanic, and that she had worked as an advocate for disadvantaged families there. She claimed that they had been on their way back to New Hampshire from California when her husband abandoned her and the children at a gas station and took with him her purse, her money, and her ID. She did have $50 in her pocket, and she bought the bus tickets, she said, and then they had nothing. But Mary Lou was still impressed with Robin, believing her to be very strong and brave. She created a daytime shelter program and put Robin in charge. Robin seemed to be really good at her job and gained Mary Lou's complete trust. Robin had abandoned her old life in California and was really settling into this new life in Boise. But she didn't stay a single parent for long. In March of 1988, she met 31-year-old Randy Rowe. He was dating Polly, a friend of Robin's. Over drinks, Polly introduced Randy to Robin, and Randy and Robin went home together that night and were together from then on. After 2.5 months, they were married. It was a small service with neither the bride's nor the groom's family members there. And after moving many times over the next 4 years, Robin and Randy settled in with her two children in a duplex in southwest Boise. In October, hours after Robin and her co-worker had locked up their office and gone home, two mothers living upstairs heard a noise coming from beneath them. It sounded like something was dropped or broken, and it really struck them as unusual because it was always quiet there at 1 a.m. Soon after, though, they smelled an unusual odor. They decided it was nothing, but then around 3:30, the smell was much more noticeable. The fire department was called, and by the time they arrived, the fire was a full blaze in the office. Firefighters estimated that it had been burning for about 2.5 hours. Smoke damage was visible on the walls, and the desk and the filing cabinet drawers had been opened and charred, so it was an arson fire for sure. The upstairs residents had no access to that basement. There were only 4 people who had a key to that office. The 2 female employees, who were Robin and a woman named Fran, a daytime supervisor, and the cleaning person. When questioned by investigators, Robin, Fran, and the cleaning person insisted that when they left, the office door had been locked and the heater had been shut off. So no one could understand why anyone would want to break into a shelter for homeless people, and there was nothing missing. But this case went unsolved. The damage, though, totaled $35,000. And it's very interesting to note that included in this were Christmas presents of Robin's that she said she had purchased and that was destroyed in the fire and that were covered by insurance. So everywhere she goes, fire follows her.
It does.
And she usually makes money off of it.
Now that same month, Randy Rowe's life changed forever. He crashed into a pickup truck on his motorcycle, and this happened at a time he was not wearing a helmet. So he was rushed to the hospital with a severe head injury that left him in a coma. By December, he was well enough to be moved to the Veterans Administration Hospital for rehab. Robin didn't visit him as much as her in-laws thought was appropriate. She was now the sole supporter and caretaker in her household, and soon she would be caring for Randy at home also. Now, to alleviate some of the burden on Robin, the teachers at the kids' school prepared and delivered food to the Rowe family. And employees of the YWCA decided to cancel their usual gift exchange, and they took up a collection to help Robin with her expenses. A local radio station accepted pleas for needy families, and those with the greatest need were chosen to receive donations, money, clothes, gift certificates, toys, rent, and groceries. Now, they also received an anonymous letter in the mail requesting help for the Rowe family. And there were some people that suspected that Robin had written this letter herself.
Well, whoever did it, it did work. That Christmas, Robin received a $100 gift certificate for gas, $200 gift certificate for grocery store, and also toys from Santa for Joshua and Tabitha. Randy improved enough to come home in February of 1990, but he was unable to work. So he became a house husband and took care of the children while Robin worked. Robin let her children's teachers know that she couldn't be available during the day because she worked, so if there was anything the children needed, they should call Randy. And from what the teachers saw, Robin seemed like a caring, busy, working mother, and she seemed appropriately interested in her children's well-being. She seemed like a decent mom. But Randy was bickering with the kids, and Robin said that made it really hard for her to cope. She often was seen losing her temper and screaming at Randy or the kids. Robin would complain to people that she had to walk Randy through even the simplest tasks, and she said she felt guilty about no longer wanting to be with him. The romance was over after just 2 years together, and Robin felt trapped in the relationship. At the same time, things just couldn't have been going any better at her job. She was put in charge of the charitable bingo program, which became very successful for a time. And it was while Robin was working at the YWCA that she met her very close friend, Joan McHugh. Joan was older, she was from Boston, and she had found herself alone and homeless in Boise when her husband went off to rehab for alcoholism. Robin really took care of Joan, though, helping her find housing and a job. In the evenings, Robin managed bingo, and Joan ran the canteen. They spent more time with each other than they did with their own families, even after Joan's husband Bernie returned to live with her. So they would carpool to work and socialize together in their free time. Their friendship grew into a mother-daughter type of relationship. With Joan, Robin talked about her life's ups and downs, and Joan was a really sympathetic listener. Following his parents, Danny McHugh, Joan's 31-year-old son, moved to Boise from Boston in June. He brought along his 5-year-old son, Ryan, as well. And the two moved in with Joan and Bernie, staying together in one of the 2 bedrooms in their apartment.
The two families began spending more time together. They shared backyard barbecues, day trips, and birthdays. Robin noticed right away that Danny was a pretty good-looking guy. And then when Robin offered him a job as a bingo runner, one night a week, he happily accepted. And then gradually, Robin added more hours to Danny's schedule. In December of 1991, Robin, Randy, Joshua, and Tabitha flew to New Hampshire over Christmas and New Year's to visit Robin's family. Now, Joan and others wondered how Robin, who was living from paycheck to paycheck, could afford the expensive trip. Robin had just bought a new bedroom furniture set for Tabitha, new rings for herself and Randy, and a TV for each of the kids. She sent $200 cash and $100 worth of toys to her sister Terry and her children, and gave each relative back east $100 cash also. She told them that she had won a lottery. Robin explained to Joan that she had been saving her money and used coupons when she could, but that really couldn't explain how she afforded so much.
No, it was a lengthy vacation across the country for 4 people.
Yeah.
On a very limited income.
Yeah.
Plus all this other stuff, it was pretty ridiculous, and even Joan was thinking, that's weird. Now, Joan also knew that Robin had a crush on her son Danny. It seemed to her that Danny was all Robin wanted to talk about anymore. Out of nowhere, with a girlish giggle, Robin would often ask about him. And Joan was aware that Danny saw his relationship with Robin differently than she did. In his mind, they were just good friends, but Robin definitely wanted more. Then in January of 1992, Robin really shocked Joan by telling her that Randy was physically abusing her. She started to show up at work with bandages, and she would tell Joan to go along with her lies to protect Randy. Then late one night, Joan got this very upsetting call from Robin. Robin whispered into the receiver that Randy had been beating her and had thrown her up against a wall. She said her ribs were hurting. Joan felt very close to Robin and felt a lot of sympathy for her, and she began to feel angry at Randy. Now remember, Randy had a brain injury, and Robin would say he just isn't the same anymore. He's not normal, and he has these violent outbursts. which seems like it could make sense, but nobody ever saw that, except Robin. So Joan told Robin repeatedly that she needed to call the police and move out, but Robin said she couldn't leave him. So the day after that phone call, Robin told Joan that her ribs were taped up to ease the pain when she moved. Joan was very concerned and begged her to get help, but Robin again said she just couldn't. To save herself from embarrassment, Robin said, she and Joan told the people at work that she had fallen down the stairs into a cabinet. Later that same week, Robin arrived at the bingo hall with bandages around her arm and a band-aid on her face. And she told another YMCA co-worker that Randy had been hitting her. So as the stories of abuse became more common, Robin began spending more time at Joan's apartment. They had a really small apartment, but they allowed Robin to sleep on a couch on the first floor near the door. She told Joan that Randy wouldn't let her out of the house sometimes, and that he had put special locks on the windows and doors, so she couldn't escape. She seemed really eager to share her stories of abuse, but she wasn't interested in taking any advice or getting any help to get away from Randy. So it had taken some time for Joan to believe that Randy could really be hurting Robin, because all she'd seen with Randy was a gentle, you know, a little bit slow guy. Whenever she saw him, he seemed really kind and very subservient to Robin as well. But Robin told Joan that Randy had two sides to him. As Joan pressured Robin more and more to get help and get away from Randy, Robin started to make up stories. She said police and mental health workers had come to her home to medicate Randy on site and to put together plans to have him arrested and locked up. She told Joan that she had called the police numerous times. And Joan was buying into all this. She began to feel anger, not only toward Randy, but then toward the police, who, in her opinion, were just letting her friends suffer in this abusive relationship and not doing their jobs. But in reality, Robin was really just setting the scene here for her worst crime yet.
Careful planning, right?
Really seems like it.
In February of 1992, the bingo operation was falling apart. This was due to Robin taking most of the money for herself. Randy was frustrated with Robin's frequent absences from home, and he felt certain she was having at least one affair. Friday, February 7th, Robin and Joan drove to the elementary school to pick up Joshua and Tabitha. Now, Robin told Joan that her plan was to take the kids to California to stay with Jack and Alice Woods before Randy knew they were gone. But they got to school and they were too late. Randy had already picked up the kids. So Robin told Joan, Randy kidnapped the children. She left the room, she pretended to call the police, and came back to tell Joan that the only thing the police could do was pick Randy up Monday morning when he took the kids to school. So that night, Robin and Joan went to work, and that same night, Robin slept downstairs on the couch near the front door of Joan's apartment. Saturday morning, when Joan got up, she saw that Robin was gone, and she didn't see her again until late that afternoon. When Robin returned, she was in a rage. Her husband, she said, had not only kidnapped her children, but he had destroyed her home. The house was a mess, Robin told Joan. Her clothes had been destroyed. Her side of the mattress had been slashed. All of her knickknacks had been smashed. He really went through the house.
Yeah, so Robin continued to sleep at Joan's place. And on Sunday, Tabitha called to ask her mom if she could stay up late. And Randy also called and spoke with Robin. So these conversations, at least on Robin's side, sounded very normal to Joan. And it didn't make much sense because Robin was still telling her that Randy had kidnapped the children and that the police would be picking him up on Monday morning when he took the kids to school. So it really didn't make a lot of sense. But Joan is really going to give Robin the benefit of the doubt. She sees her as a very close friend, almost like a daughter.
Yeah, it seems like she's really bending over backwards for Robin.
Yes, but remember when Joan first got there and was homeless, Robin did a lot for her.
Right, yeah.
So early that Monday morning, Robin woke up Joan and told her about a premonition that had come to her around 3 a.m. I just know something is wrong, Robin said. So it was about 5:30 a.m. when Robin and Joan climbed into Robin's car and sped off toward her duplex in her subdivision just outside of Boise. As they approached the turnoff to her street, Robin suddenly told Joan that the premonition had left her "It's probably nothing," Robin said, and she appeared to relax. Joan agreed that everything was likely fine, but she said, "We've come all this way, we might as well check." So as they approached the intersection, they saw red and blue flashing lights reflecting off of the buildings and the trees. Then Robin began to cry out that her house was on fire. But when Joan looked around, she couldn't see the house, and she couldn't see any flames. She couldn't see through the fog to make out what Robin was talking about. But she was silently praying that the children were okay. These were like grandchildren to her. So Robin's turn signal was blinking when a police officer approached the driver's side window, and he told Robin that she couldn't drive past. But she yelled that her house was right down the street and her children were inside. "Pull your car over," the officer told her, and directed Robin to park at the curb. Then the two women got out of the car and followed the officer toward the flashing lights. Still unsure about what they would find, Joan stopped, and then she did see Robin's duplex. She saw flames shooting out from Joshua's bedroom window. So Joan had never seen a house fire up close, and it was really frightening. Then Robin started to run toward the fire, but an officer restrained her. She was taken back to an ambulance parked nearby, where she sat down in the back doorway. A paramedic told her that they had found a boy dead inside. Knowing it had to be 10-year-old Joshua, but still not accepting it, Joan cried out and Robin screamed. The paramedic explained to Robin that the fireman could see an adult body inside too, which was likely her husband Randy, lying on the bed, but that the floor was too hot to get to him, and they hadn't found 8-year-old Tabitha, but they still didn't think anyone had escaped the fire.
EMT Barbara Whitty helped the two women inside the ambulance to evaluate them. Robin asked her several times if she could see her dead son. "No, you don't want to see him there," Whitty answered. "You'll have to wait until the coroner takes him to the morgue." The EMT was certain that if Robin saw her son on the front lawn, burnt and disfigured, it would be too traumatic for her. Tabitha was eventually found. She was on the floor, near the foot of her parents' bed. And as the firefighters searched for the child, Robin had finally remembered that Tabitha would often get up in the night and sleep there. Buried under books and pieces of the collapsed ceiling, Tabitha was found in a sleeping pose, wearing pink underwear and a multicolored flowery top. She was looking toward the doorway with her arm outstretched, as if she was reaching for someone to save her. She was blackened, with third-degree burns on both her upper and lower body, but she was still recognizable. Now, the coroner concluded that Randy Rowe and his stepchildren, Tabitha and Joshua, had all died of carbon monoxide poisoning and had been dead for hours. The firemen felt sympathy for the mother outside, who was left alive to suffer the loss of the entire family. In the days that followed, many of the first responders had difficulty sleeping. Now, it was a tragic fire, but there's something strange about it also. There were the piles of laundry that had been scattered around the living room, some heaped up against a portable electric heater. That sounds familiar.
Yes, it's very similar to the shack where little Keith died.
No fire alarm was ever heard. Investigators would conclude that the fire had been set intentionally downstairs with a slowly burning flammable substance. The circuit breaker and the smoke detector were shut off, and the fan of the furnace was set to run continuously. So this allowed the fan to feed the flames and circulate smoke throughout the duplex.
Because of everything Robin had told them about Randy, Joan, Bernie, and David all believed that he had killed the children and himself because Robin was going to file for divorce. It was his way of getting back at her, Robin said. Robin went back to Joan's apartment, and Joan tried as best she could to comfort her. But Robin seemed really nervous and couldn't sit still. She walked around the apartment, stripping all the beds and doing the laundry, and Joan took most of the sympathy calls that came in from people. A lot of support came from Robin's friends and YWCA co-workers. Mary Lou, the soup kitchen coordinator at St. Michael's who had first helped Robin, went to the morgue to identify the bodies for her. A local newspaper set up a bank account for donations for Robin, and by noontime the media was announcing the names of the victims. The women who worked with Robin at the YWCA felt overwhelming sadness for the loss of these children. They knew and really cared about Joshua and Tabitha. Those two kids had been visiting the office ever since Robin had started working at the YWCA back in 1989. Tabitha used to sit at her mother's desk and draw pictures for the staff. So Joan felt she should be strong and help Robin make decisions. They discussed the funeral arrangements and where they would get money, and Joan asked her about insurance. Robin told her that she had a small amount of insurance on the children that was part of her benefit package at work. She didn't think she had any insurance on Randy because after his motorcycle accident, she believed that he had been uninsurable. But as it turned out, the county paid for the cremation and the burial plots were donated, and Joan bought the urns for the remains of Joshua and Tabitha. Because Robin decided she wanted to get the memorial service over with, she moved up her plans of a Saturday service to that Wednesday, just 2 days after the fire. On Monday afternoon, Sheriff's Detective Gary Rainey called the McHugh home to speak with Robin. When she got off the phone, Robin told Joan that the investigator wanted to talk with her that afternoon. She was clearly upset and nervous. She said she didn't like detectives and didn't want to see Detective Gary Rainey, but she knew there was really no way out of doing it.
When he first read the report from the Row House fire, Detective Rainey kept an open mind. But then calls began to come into the sheriff's office with suspicions. Acquaintances of Randy's family called, basically telling him that they thought there was more to this fire than met the eye. Then at 8:24 in the morning, a call came in from an agitated woman, turned out to be June Rowe, Randy Rowe's mother. She wanted to talk to someone about the call she had just gotten from Randy's wife, telling her that he and the kids had been killed in a fire. Shortly after the call from Randy's mother, one of Randy's older sisters called the sheriff's office. "Is it true?" she asked. "'Cause if it is, my sister-in-law killed them all." Most members of the Rowe family believed that Randy had been dominated by Robin. And when the family began talking to each other, kind of comparing notes and stuff, they concluded that Robin had to be responsible for the fire.
Yeah, now it wasn't really unusual for the sheriff's office to receive accusations like that when there was a tragedy. And Detective Rainey wasn't super concerned about those calls at first. But the calls, the wife of the deceased showing up at the scene, and the firefighter's interpretation of what happened was enough to make him take a much closer look. A little after 9 a.m., Detective Rainey went to the scene and met with the arson investigator, Assistant Chief Doug McGrew, and Chief Deputy State Fire Marshal Don Dillard. The investigators filled him in on what had happened. It was known from the first examination that the fire originated inside of a closet near the exit from the house into the garage. And they also found a second area of origin, a burn spot where clothing had been piled in front of a large TV set. The physical evidence pointed strongly to arson. The fire investigators spent the entire day Monday going through what was left. Rainey approached his investigation from a different angle. A pile of clothing lying on a living room carpet doesn't just spontaneously ignite. So he would gather evidence and either disprove his theory or prove it. The fire investigators had come across a pour pattern as well in the Rowe home. So someone had poured some kind of flammable liquid across the living room carpet from the stairway by the front door to the interior of the closet near the door to the garage. Someone had intentionally dampened that carpet with an accelerant and put a match to it. But he hadn't yet found any evidence pointing to a specific suspect. They knew that they had uncovered a triple homicide, though. He was sure of that. The home was a crime scene. They roped it off with evidence tape, and they had guards watch it 24 hours a day. Rainey learned that the children who had died in the fire were Robin's natural children and Randy's stepchildren. It appeared to be common knowledge that Robin was going to divorce Randy. Rainey also learned that Randy had been in a motorcycle accident that had caused some permanent mental disabilities, so Rainey met with the coroner, who confirmed that the three victims of the house fire had died from breathing lethal levels of carbon monoxide. When Rainey saw the corpse of Randy Rowe, he noted that the body was charred, especially on the face, trunk, and abdomen. And it was obvious from the post-mortem lividity that had settled in his body that he had been lying on his side at the time of his death, likely in a sleeping position. His tongue protruded from his mouth, and the fingers of both of his hands had clawing caused from post-mortem rigidity. Tabitha's body was the most severely burned of the three victims. Joshua wasn't burned nearly as much, but he had the highest level of carbon monoxide in his blood, so this meant that he had likely breathed the poison the longest. All three, though, had died of smoke inhalation, and likely without regaining any consciousness. What bothered Rainey the most, though, was the probability that these three innocent people were dead because of the evil actions of one other person. But who was that person? They certainly needed to take a look at Robin.
Well, I think he's got an idea.
Yes, but I think he was trying not to jump to conclusions.
Okay. So, Bernie McHugh drove Robin to the sheriff's office to talk to Detective Rainey 2 o'clock that afternoon. Rainey wanted to talk to Robin not as a suspect at first, but as a witness. So they had a hidden camera and microphones to record the interview. Rainey introduced Robin to Detective Ken Smith. He would assist him with the interview. Now, these are two experienced detectives. They'd worked together on many cases, so many they are sometimes accused of playing good cop, bad cop. In a soft, compassionate voice, Rainey explained the process they used to understand how the fire started. To get an idea of Robin's level of honesty, Rainey deliberately led her to believe there was extensive damage in the duplex, when in fact there wasn't, and there were a lot of clues that were found inside. So Robin was cooperative. She agreed to draw a diagram of the interior of the home. Using a pen and pad on the desk, she drew and described it room by room. When asked, she said that she wasn't aware of any electrical problems. But she did add that Randy sometimes went out at night and turned off the breaker, doing that so that Tabitha wouldn't watch the TV in her room at night. So Randy says, well, why didn't he just take the TV? It just seemed to him like a strange thing to do, since the breaker switch would turn off much of the electricity upstairs. Oh, it was a constant argument between us, Robin sighed, rolling her eyes. Then she explained about a 2-plug outlet that she said Randy had converted to a multiple outlet, and there were 5 electrical appliances attached to it. The arson investigators had made note of that multiple connection, thinking it was strange because there were certainly enough wall outlets to use for all the appliances. So Rainey asked whether she or Randy kept any solvents, such as engine degreaser, kerosene, diesel, gasoline. Robin said Randy might have had a small gas can for the lawnmower. She added that her husband used an electric heater every once in a while for his arm. Last year he had a seizure and he burnt his arm with hot water, she said. His arm turns purple and he uses the heater in the living room to heat his arm. But she said that the heater had not been in the living room when she left there over the weekend. She said that he had put it back out in the garage when he was done.
Yes, so that heater had been found in the living room with clothes in front of it. And if it was normally stored in the garage and was not out when Robin was last there, Rainey wondered why she'd even brought it up. Robin said that she had been sleeping at her friend's house since Thursday because she and Randy weren't getting along. She said that she had spoken with him Sunday evening and that he told her he was locking her out of the house. She had a key, but they had those swing locks that are installed at the top of the door and make it so you can't get in even with a key. So according to Robin, Randy would use those locks to lock her out when he was angry with her. But Rainey was also curious about Robin's so-called premonition that her house was on fire. When asked if she slept through the night, she said that she hadn't. She'd been restless. She'd had the premonition at 3 a.m., so she'd done some laundry and showered at Joan's house. But since Joan, Bernie, and Danny were all upstairs asleep, there was no one who could give her an alibi. She could have easily gone out to the duplex, started a slow-burning fire, and returned to Jones. And then it would make sense for her to take a shower and wash her clothing to remove any evidence that she had started the fire. Rainey had heard from relatives and co-workers that Robin had lost children before. And she explained that her daughter Christina had died of SIDS, and her son Keith had died in a fire. Rainey knew that Robin was free to leave that interview. So he said to her, there's some evidence that something was set on fire out there. One of the things we're going to do is take a laser out there. So this was a technique where he would just make something up to get a perpetrator to reveal themselves. He said smoke works real well setting things in, like footprints and fingerprints, and it also will tell us the timing of things. I think we're going to have some pretty good evidence coming out of there to tell us exactly what happened. So if Robin had anything to do with the fire, he was hoping this would give her away. But she was tough. It didn't seem to bother her.
Yeah, but other detectives and staff who had observed the interview over the monitor agreed that Robin's behavior was off and not even close to being appropriate to the situation. And before ending the interview, Rainey took Robin's statistical information and then he tried what's called a bait question. The reason for the delay is that the fire department called in, he told Robin. They'd been checking with some of the neighbors and somebody said they thought they saw your car there early this morning. Would there be any reason? Robin said. Not until 5 o'clock or so. Would there be any reason anybody would have seen the car at that location before? No, because I had it at Jones. So she wasn't taking the bait. But Rainey was definitely going to be interviewing her again. He had begun the interview with what he thought was a grieving widow, and he now had someone who he thought might be a suspect. Something certainly didn't feel right to him about Robin Lee Rowe.
Well, now Joan already had a distrust of the police, so when Detective Rainey called her to ask her to come to the sheriff's office later that evening and answer some questions, she was anxious to give them a piece of her mind. She felt positive that Randy had set the fire, but she worried that the police were going to twist her words and use them to frame Robin. Joan was Robin's biggest defender until Rainey filled her in on all of Robin's lies. Robin had never actually called the police about Randy abusing her. There was no evidence at all that he had even been abusive. No witnesses either. Then there was all of the check kiting and stealing she had done. Robin had told Joan that she had $2,500 worth of life insurance on the children through the YWCA. What she didn't tell her, or the police for that matter, was that she had 5 other policies through 4 different insurance companies that if they paid off, would pay her over $250,000.
Well, Robin certainly learned how this insurance stuff works.
Well, in a way, but how would she ever think that the police wouldn't figure this out?
Oh, well.
That's really stupid.
Yeah.
So Danny McHugh had slept with Robin a couple of times. She had been very persistent. So he definitely had to be interviewed and eliminated as a suspect. Make sure this wasn't some kind of love triangle. But Robin was definitely obsessed with Danny. After the police questioned him, the prosecutors and the police were sure that he wasn't involved. A newspaper delivery man did call in and claim that he had seen Robin's car there around 4 a.m., driving away from the duplex, but they had only seen one person in the car. Rainey had figured out that Robin had the opportunity to commit the crime as well. It was a 20-minute drive from the apartment where Joan lived out to the Seneca Street duplex. So that gave her 20 minutes to get out there, 20 minutes to start the fire, and 20 minutes to get back. So the whole thing could easily be done in an hour. Now remember, she'd been sleeping by the front door on a couch, so she could come and go without Joan even knowing. Also, Joan had been really anxious that night because of the abuse Robin had told her about. So Joan had slept in fits and starts. And she had heard the washer and shower running early that morning before Robin came up and woke her up to tell her about her premonition. So on Friday, March 20th, 1992, Robin was being held in the county jail on the theft charges. While she was being held, the arson and murder investigation continued. As part of the investigation, Detective Rainey suggested to Joan McHugh that she put a tape recorder on her telephone and record conversations between her and Robin, because she was sure that Robin would call her from jail. And the same day at 11:30 a.m., the state presented probable cause to a magistrate for 3 counts of first-degree murder, and a warrant was issued for Robin's arrest. That afternoon at 1 p.m., there was a press conference announcing the filing of criminal charges. About the same time as the press conference, Robin found out that charges were going to be filed against her, and she called Joan from the jail. At the suggestion of Detective Rainey, Joan told Robin that she had awakened during the night of the fire and had gone downstairs, but then couldn't find Robin anywhere in the apartment. So Robin told Joan that she was not inside because she was outside talking to her psychiatrist. Robin called Joan again at 2:05 that day, and reiterated that she'd been talking to her psychiatrist until about 4:30 a.m. on the night of the fire. But the very suspicious thing, the thing that really turned Joan, was that Robin refused to name the psychiatrist. So it was clearly a lie.
Clearly. I'm amazed that she ever told the truth.
Yes. That had been pretty clever. They'd tricked her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, on Monday, March 23rd at 10 in the morning, Detective Rainey went to the jail and advised Robin that she was under arrest for 3 counts of first-degree murder. Robin made her first appearance in court later that afternoon at 1 o'clock. 2 public defenders were appointed to her defense. Now, her trial lasted from late January to early March of 1993, and she was found guilty on all charges. Her sentencing hearing began that October. The state chose not to offer any additional evidence in aggravation. Defense counsel presented the testimony of 3 witnesses, in addition to letters written in support of Robin, and Robin gave an unsworn statement in court. At the conclusion of the hearing, the trial court found that 4 statutory aggravating circumstances had been proven by the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. That is, 1, she committed multiple murders at the same time. 2, the murders were committed during an arson, making them first-degree felony murders, and were accompanied by a specific intent to kill. 3, the murders were committed for remuneration or the promise of remuneration, money, life insurance. 4, Roe exhibited an utter disregard for human life. Now, the court also found several facts in mitigation, including that Robin had endured a difficult and abusive childhood. She had shown responsibility in the past. She did not have an extensive record of violent crimes. She was involved in a mutually abusive relationship with Randy, and she suffered from various mental, psychological, and personality problems. So the court considered all the mitigating circumstances and concluded that mitigation did not outweigh the aggravating circumstance.
So on December 16, 1993, the trial court sentenced Robin to death for the murder convictions and 20 years fixed for the aggravated arson. Many people believe that Robin killed her other 2 children, of course, Christina and Keith. This includes her sister Terry, who's been quoted as saying that Robin did not deserve to live. Those are strong words. So all of her appeals have failed. On appeal, her defense argued that her trial attorneys were deficient in handling her motion to suppress statements made to Joan McHugh while she was incarcerated on the unrelated theft charges. They also asserted that her attorneys could have challenged the statements on the basis of the delay in charging and arraigning her. The court found that her attorneys acted appropriately and decided that the court would have denied that motion anyway. So she's the only death row inmate in Pocatello Women's Correctional Center in Idaho. And now she's 64 years old, I believe.
Yeah, 1957.
So I don't think she'll be getting out.
Nope, she won't.
TCB's music is written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you have comments, a case suggestion, or a beer recommendation, please go ahead and send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com. You can also go to our website, tygrabber.com, and write your comments for us there. Or even better, leave us a voicemail. Your voicemail may be played on an upcoming episode, and we would love to hear from you. There's a widget on our website where you can click to record your message. And as always, I will include a direct link in our show notes for you to click and record your voicemail. If you would like to get all your future TCB episodes commercial-free, get an extra members-only episode each month, and have us send you a gift with a thank you note and some swag, you might want to consider subscribing as a Tie Grabber. When you join, you'll have immediate access to all of our bonus episodes from the past 4 years, plus all of our other episodes without the advertisements. It's a really good deal for anyone who enjoys our show, and it's an excellent way to show your support for us. We also do have a Patreon page where you can subscribe for ad-free and bonus content. If you're interested in that, just go to patreon.com/tiegrabber to learn more about it. Also, if you enjoy our show, we would really appreciate it if you would leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen. One more thing. We will be taking the last 2 weeks of June off as we go to Maine and visit some relatives we haven't seen in over a year and a half. We'll miss doing the show, but we'll come back refreshed with all kinds of new ideas, I hope. Also, we'll be checking our emails and voicemails from Maine, so you can keep that feedback coming in. What do we have for feedback today, Dickie?
2 voicemails and 1 email. And the first voicemail is from Araminta, and she has a case suggestion.
Hi, Jill and Dick. My name is Araminta Verwise. Araminta is my first name. It's not Aaron, as most people call me. Or you can call me Minty, Minty Verwise. Hey, I enjoy your podcast so much. They're so in-depth. They get investigated from even the families and just the way that you both bring this story to life. And so living here in Michigan, we've had a case that I would really like for you guys to do. And it's because you guys would investigate it and I'd hear the whole background information, everything. It's a case that's kind of taken over Michigan for the past years and years. And it's the story of baby Kate. Her father was found guilty of killing her, but she's never been found. And it went through so many different twists and turns. And yeah, it would be really interesting to hear the background and you guys' point of view. And I just love your commentary. I love that Jill is upbeat and has like really beautiful voice and that has all this energy to it. And then you have Dick who has this creamy, smooth voice. And you know, I'm in Michigan, so it might give you a chance to open another Founders Brewery beer from Grand Rapids. So that would be interesting. I know you guys like that. So anyways, I would really, really enjoy having this case be done by the both of you. So I hope you have a blessed and happy day, and I can't wait for your next podcast. Bye, guys.
Thanks, Minty. I'm thinking if Minty was a rapper, we'd call her Minty Fresh. That'd be really cool. Isn't that a cute name?
Yeah. See if she's interested in that career.
So I did look at this case a little bit, and a jury found the father, Sean Phillips, guilty of killing Catherine Phillips, also known as Baby Kate. He was actually sentenced to 19 to 45 years in prison. Prosecutors said that he had a really turbulent relationship with the baby's mother, and he didn't want the baby. So Assistant Attorney General Donna Pendergrass told juries at his trial that Kate was a financial burden and an impediment to his lifestyle. So he actually had written a note to Kate's mother where he described how in a fit of anger, Kate was somehow thrown from her car seat when he yanked at the seat. And he wrote that he held her for a long time and that she was in a peaceful place. Now, he didn't elaborate on that, but this just sounds like a very sad case. Which doesn't mean we won't cover it, but I'd really like to investigate it and see if we have a story to tell to shed some light on this crime. It appears like these were young people, young parents, and the father was just a real loser.
Yeah, that's the impression. I didn't look too much up about it, so we certainly need to find out how much info there is.
Absolutely. I think that's a good suggestion. And here's our next email from Evie.
Hi, my name is Evie. I actually live in Jerusalem, and I'm a huge fan of your podcast. In about a minute, I'm gonna have my 2 kids are going to come running in here, so I have 2 seconds to talk. But first of all, I really, really enjoy your outlook and how you guys, you know, the different cases that you've chosen. I had an idea. Again, I had a suggestion, but I went through all of your videos. I don't think you did it, but maybe you did and I didn't notice. The HEIDT, Craig Height, Robin Height, the lengths of what a person would do to who is in love with his sister-in-law. And it's very complex murders. And to this day, not everyone is sure about a certain person and what she knew and what she didn't. And another case, it was the Nathan Luthold case, Nathan and Denise Luthold. Again, you might have done it and I didn't notice. And in general, I just want to say thank you so much for your podcast. And it's funny because I live in the Middle East, which is not exactly a relaxing place to live. And I choose to relax and chill by listening to true crime, which some may find weird, but I really enjoy it. And thank you. And I'm going to enjoy to be listening in the future. Then that's it. Thank you so much.
It recorded.
Yes, it did.
So thank you. But I totally relate to relaxing to true crime. That's
yes.
Not weird at all. What are you talking about? That's totally normal.
Right.
So this case, Robin and Carrie Height, they seemed to have this perfect marriage. They had three kids. And Robin was having an affair, though, with Carrie's brother, Craig. So Craig killed Carrie and their father and attempted to murder their mother. Looked into this a little bit, and I did see that there's a 48 Hours episode on this case. So
yeah, we'll check that out.
Let's watch that and see what we think.
Yeah, because this is a familiar thing. The mother still thinks he's innocent, even though he tried to kill her.
So that makes it interesting. I like those dynamics, sure. So our next case suggestion is from Paul. And this is a case suggestion we've had before, so I looked a little more into it. It is about killer cop James Duckett. Paul says it's a fantastic story about a cop who is probably guilty, but based on the evidence, should never have been convicted. He also says he's suspected in another child murder, and he also says he loves listening to us. Keep up the good work. So what I found is that James Duckett was a policeman in Mascot, Florida, on May 11th, 1987, when he picked up an 11-year-old girl named Teresa Maccabee from a convenience store where she'd gone to buy a pencil. And at 11 p.m. that night, Teresa's mother was looking for her when the clerk at the store told her that Teresa had left with Duckett in his patrol car. Teresa's mother went to the police station, but her daughter wasn't there. Duckett had been out of contact on his police radio from 9:50 p.m. until 12:10 a.m. that night. And then Teresa's body was found in a lake less than a mile from the convenience store. So physical evidence connecting Duckett to her murder was found, and he went to trial for her murder. I believe he was also the only policeman on duty that night in that area. So I'm really curious to find out why Paul said that he should never have been convicted, because it sounds kind of open and shut from the little blurb
I
read.
I was going to ask you the same thing.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
But we're definitely going to look into this, Paul, because you're not the first one to recommend it, and because I think it sounds very interesting.
So there you go.
So there you go. Some great case suggestions. We appreciate it, and we look forward to getting more in the future.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you so much, and we'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
We'll be there.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.